Hey, and welcome to Future Thinkers. Today, our guest is Dr. Dana Baumeister, the co-founder of Biomimicry 3.8, a project that trains changemakers in sustainable design principles inspired by nature's forms, processes, and ecosystems. Dana and her business partner, Janine Benyus, have developed the biomimicry movement as a response to the world's sustainability problems.
In this episode, we talk about how we can learn from nature to be more resilient and self-sustainable, raise better adapted kids, and adopt the everyday practices to improve our chances of overcoming the climate and economic challenges ahead. For all the links and show notes, go to futurethinkers.org/109.
Enter the Future Thinkers giveaway and win our brand new community membership, including in-depth courses, private calls, and more, as well as a supply of Qualia, a complete cognitive upgrade for your brain. To enter the contest, simply go to futurethinkers.org/giveaway and sign up for our mailing list to instantly get our 50-page guide on how to adapt to the future. There are many ways to increase your chances of winning. Enter the competition today.
Hey, and welcome to futurethinkers.org, a podcast about the evolution of technology, society, and consciousness. I'm Mike Gilliland.
And I'm Yuvia Ivanova. If you're new to the show and you want to get a list of our favorite books, popular episodes, and to join our community, go to futurethinkers.org/start.
And so now I'm in one of the most progressive cities in America, and that's just amazing. I mean, everything that you read about that could be possible, like, even, you know, stuff like city composting and, yeah, you know, everybody has a compost pile. You know, all those things are all happening here. And there's a heck of a lot more people, you know. Yeah. And so I'm getting used to, like, I can hear the interstate from my house, which is quite jarring to me because before I couldn't hear any sounds in Montana. And so I'm sort of learning to adjust. But I had to drive my car to get anywhere in Montana, and I can walk everywhere here, right? So there's these different pieces. It's a good reflection about, you know, what is the world that we want, and why, and what's it going to take to get there, and how do we manage, you know, in the spirit of where we're heading with this conversation, you know, how do we manage populations, population diversity, different backgrounds, different perspectives, and you know, what everybody wants in a way that serves society as a whole and takes care of the planet at the same time. And coming from a very conservative background into one that's extremely liberal, and like, I'm left of left, so it's great to be amongst a community that I can relate to. It also reminds me of how little the progressive liberal community understands of the perspectives. And they're not bad people. They're not wrong. They're not just uneducated and all they need is education. They just have a different set of priorities, in their lives. And a lot of them do make sense. And I believe we're a lot more in common than we want to give each other credit for. And it's unfortunate that we focus so much on the differences as opposed to what we have in common. So in the spirit of, you know, your conversation and where society goes as a whole, I think it behooves us to actually recognize what we do have in common. And that's one thing that biomimicry offers that's so fascinating is, I mean, there's very few people who are like, nature, she doesn't know what she's talking about, right? Like, I mean, so no matter what your background and your perspective is, everyone kind of agrees that nature's gotten a lot of things figured out.
Yeah.
Now, there's a population that's in total awe of that, right? That in awe and wonder. And there is a population that's somewhat in fear of that, right? Oh, thank God I don't have to worry about bugs and germs and my family's safe and I don't have to worry about lightning and hailstorms and, you know, whatever. But then, of course, Daya reminds us every now and then that, no, actually, you do have to pay attention, right? Like, that you didn't get that last message, I'll stir up an even stronger hurricane for you. Just, you know, just you wait. And I think if we
what it's like without electricity.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
We'll remind you. Exactly. So it's, and so I think but yet we all still want, you know, health and well-being for our family. We want community. And why not focus on that and create a vision that works for all? I think where both sides are failing miserably.
Yeah.
It seems like there's that huge gap between, nature is over there and we are over here and we're trying to, you know, provide for ourselves and our families and our societies and kind of just try to keep nature out and occasionally take things from it that are useful for us.
Yeah, it's exactly true. And I mean, it's understandable, right? So for, remember that as a species, we've been around for 300,000 years. And the vast majority of that time, it was only 10,000 years ago that we planted the first seeds, right? So that we started agriculture. So for 290,000 years, we were nomadic. We were hunter-gatherers. And pretty much the vast majority of our threats came from nature. And so you can imagine sort of the developmental programming in our brains that have said, okay, be cautious. We can't be entirely fearful because we are part of nature. We are, you know, we live in it. It's part of us. We depend on it for our food, our shelter, and so on. So you can't strip yourself of it. But definitely when somebody died in a community, there was a good chance, unless it was from some sort of tribal warfare, that it was something in nature. Right? And so we have that inherent cautiousness. And really, since, you know, the dawn of agriculture, we've been trying to reduce that risk. We've been trying to tame that risk. Well, let's plant our own food so we don't have to worry about when the seasons are going to make certain things available to us or not, or we won't have to walk as far to find certain crops. What if we bring those crops to ourselves? So we've been trying to remove that variability, unpredictability, unsafeness. And of course, fast forward 10,000 years, and we put in air conditioning in our houses so we don't have to adapt to the temperature. We put in heat in our houses so we don't freeze, and then we seal things off. And the effect is that we keep pushing nature away from us. And the more we push away, the more disconnected we become. And then we develop two things. One, we forget that there's so much wisdom in that, right? We sort of forget to love that thing called nature. And we start creating this false dichotomy and belief that we don't need nature. Like, we got this. We can take care of all of our needs, and we are immune to the laws of natural selection, or we're immune to weather, or whatever it might be. I liken it to, one of the planetary conditions is that it's in a state of what's called dynamic non-equilibrium. And dynamic implies change, right? Things are always changing. And of course, you know, we're programmed to think we can somehow manage and control change as opposed to embracing it, sort of the delight of life. So we have dynamicism, and we have a state of non-equilibria. So there is no like bottom of the bowl, right? Because the bowl is always moving, right? So yes, things will settle, which is well and good, but the bowl is always shifting. And our strategy, particularly of the Industrial Revolution, where energy became cheap, was to invest a lot of energy into holding that bowl still. Right? So we build dams to hold back water. We build big HVAC units to keep buildings a consistent temperature. We put a lot of energy into chemicals to manage the pests from our agricultural crops, whatever it might be. All this energy so that we're not subject to this rocking bowl, and we try to hold the bowl still. But then reality is showing us that there's that one, that's almost impossible. Like, you cannot keep a hurricane away. You cannot keep a tornado away. And it's the byproduct of putting so much investment into that energy, of course, because we're burning old carbon, is that we're putting that carbon back in the atmosphere, and we have the situation we have today. So these things add up, and our disconnect from nature helps us forget that, you know, just being round, if you're round, you can be in the bottom of that bowl and it's okay if it's moving. It's when we build ourselves rigid that we get disrupted in the moment.
And it seems like because we become fragile, we get used to things seeming like they're stable. And then when things get disrupted, we freak out.
Exactly.
And we don't know what to do about it.
That's right. We do not teach resilience. It's not built into the framing. It's not built into strategies. I mean, you see it in a couple of places, like diversify your portfolio, right? You know, there's a couple of places where you see the question of resilience be built in, but instead we build bigger walls, right? So I remember there was a lot of conversations in the United States after 9/11 about, you know, prevention of future terrorist attacks. And cities were looking at the fact that, for example, they only had one water supply. And rather than create resilience in the water supply, the idea was to build a bigger fence around this source of water, right? Or put up more security. Or, but the reality is there's always going to be a threat. So if you accept that there's a threat, you accept that there's a chance of something not working, then you build three different types of water supplies and you disperse them around the city. And so if one does get, you know, somebody drops some poison in it, it's okay because you got plan B and C already in place. It's a very different way of thinking, but that's the way life does it, right? Like that's how life has survived for 3.8 billion years, is it's built in that sort of resilience. Look at our immune system, right? Our immune system does not have like, you know, a single doctor in charge that is ready to, you know, be on call no matter what happens. But we know there's a good chance at some point in your life you're going to be exposed to something that is a biological threat to your health. And so we have an immune system that is three things. And this is the golden rule for resilience in nature. It's diverse, it's distributed or decentralized, and it's redundant. So we have millions and millions and millions of immune cells. We don't have one doctor. We've got, you know, 10 million doctors in our body. But we don't have only one kind of doctor. We have at least five or six different kinds of doctors. Some that are really good with bacteria, some that are really good with viruses, some that are really good at dealing with bleeding out, you know, and so on. And then because we don't know where we're going to get hit, is it coming in through the nose? Is it going in under the toenail? You know, where is it something we ate? Then they're distributed throughout the entire body. So it's an amazing system, right? An amazing system. That's resilience built into, you know, immunity. And we just need to do that in all parts of our lives, especially now that the world is going to be changing so fast in the decades ahead.
I'm so glad that that's the angle that we came into resiliency from through your field of study in nature and biomimicry, because that's a subject Yuvi and I have been discussing and thinking about so much. This, why is there this common belief that we're not resilient, that we have to wall each other off from exposure to reality, to each other, to nature? So I'm glad that you can come at this from this science angle of and just look at nature as a perfect example of how it's done.
Well, and resilience science was born in the fields of ecology, you know, understanding how does an ecosystem recover from a disturbance like a fire or a landslide or something like that. And then eventually it sort of started becoming more mainstream and more people are talking about it. There's still a lot that they're not pulling from the science, which would be good to pull. One thing I think is super interesting, and I've heard this in a couple of different places, is, you know, those of us in comfortable parts of the world, let's say the EU or in North America, actually exhibit the least amount of resilience because our lives haven't really changed all that much. They've been pretty stable. Like all those things have been taking care of us. The school bus shows up on time and so on and so on. And, you know, I've lived in other parts of the world where all those things do not lay in place very easily. And they're saying the greatest amount of innovation, creativity, and resilience is actually going to be coming from the developing world. Because that generation, you guys, grew up with a lot more chaos, if you will, right? And you had to improvise and figure things out and like, okay, well, the bus isn't showing up, so how else am I going to get to school, you know, or whatever it might be. And that sort of training and thinking will make, you know, all of those generations far more equipped. And that's really what we've tried to teach our kids too, is we have no idea what's ahead, right? We have no idea what's ahead for the world. So if we can build resilience into the next generation, then we have a really good chance of making it. There's a group in the US called P21.org, and it's Progress for a 21st Century. And they say that we need to we need to expand upon. I think they'd really like to say we need to abandon, but they'd lose followers if they said that. But the three R's, reading, writing, arithmetic, right? That was sort of the classic education. Instead, they're calling it the four C's. And I would add a fifth sort of C, an S, which is communication. Like if everybody learns how to communicate, I mean, we don't even have that basic skill, right? Communication, collaboration, right? So it's not just being able to communicate, but actually being able to work together. Creativity and critical problem solving, right? If we could teach kids those four things, then they can handle anything that comes their way. I would add systems thinking to the mix, right? So that's my fifth one. And of course, all of that comes from being in nature. Right? And that there's some really cool stuff about kids that grow up spending time in nature in a free play kind of scenario actually develop those four skills significantly, right? Because you don't have a pre-programmed board game or computer game taking care of all the details for you. Like, you got to figure out how to entertain yourself. And you got to do it in community. You got to work with all the kids that are on the block, whether you agree with them or not, and figure it out. We all have fun. So you communicate, you collaborate, and you critically problem solve. Like, okay, how are we going to get up this tree, you know, the lower branch? Or how are we going to get Joey down from the top branch? You know, he's got to be home in time for dinner. And those sorts of things, actually, those kids develop higher facultative skills. And so back to the point we were making earlier about that disconnect from nature, even something like that, like how to be well equipped in our world from the experience of navigating nature, is being stripped of so many lives. You know, I mean, we've crossed worldwide the threshold where more than half of humanity lives in an urban setting, right? Which probably means they have no connection to nature. And that's terrifying to me. Yes, it has a smaller carbon footprint. Yes, you know, the sustainability is better and easier on a per capita person in cities. So all of that makes logical sense, but my heart and my gut just thinks there's something fundamentally wrong in disconnecting people from nature. Because what are they going to love if they have no relationship with nature? If the city has served all their needs, why preserve nature? Right? Why take care of those places? And that worries me.
You know what's funny about that is my friends back home in Canada talk about parenting and how stressful it is and how, you know, they've so overscheduled their kids and they have daycare and they have so many things to take them to. And this idea of making our kids resilient and prepared for the future by letting them do their own thing in nature, it's actually a lot of pressure off the parent as well.
Oh, totally. I mean, and you ask them, maybe they're a little younger. I'm almost 50. I mean, when I was a kid, there was no pressure on mom because it was like, go and come back in time for dinner, right? Like, I just don't want to see you. Exactly. You know, and of course. Yeah, there were risks. You know, we're all swimming in the local watering hole and we're like, oh, that kind of looks like a poisonous snake. Maybe we should get out of the water. You know, like, yes, we figured that out. And what's ironic is that parents think that there's dangers out there in the woods, right? And it's safer today than it's ever been, right? All of these like stranger danger and all this stuff, it's so much safer than it had been. I mean, we have all these technologies like phones, you can track your kids, your kids can check in. I mean, all these things, and the statistics simply don't bear out. It's more dangerous to be getting your kid in the car to drive them to all the activities. You know, like that's the most dangerous thing, is to have them walk in the parking lot, you know, yeah. Or the things where people get in trouble for leaving their six-year-old in the car when they run into the grocery store for 5 minutes. But the reality is they're safer in the car than walking through the parking lot, statistically, you know, in terms of getting hurt. And it's funny because my kids are a little older now, 16 and 19, and they are reflecting on how different they are from their peers. And how when they're kind of snarky, they're like, they're so incompetent. Like, they have no idea how to do anything. And it's not difficult, but we raise them to just go do stuff, you know, figure it out. You know, like we had them, if they needed to figure out when a store closed, I mean, I would literally at like 8, I'd be like, would you call the store and find out when they close? you know, I mean, at 8, they'd call up, or, you know, 6, hi, you know, but they just figured that stuff out. So like that independence of, you know, go out and be in the woods. And yeah, I worried about mountain lions. So it's like, okay, take the dog, right? Bring the dog will take care of it. And yeah, so now they do appreciate it. They really appreciate it. Of course, they whined at the time. Why can't we have, you know, an Xbox like everybody else? And I'm like, that's not what we do. But yes, it relieves a lot of pressure on parents. And if they could see it, is that they're actually empowering their kids instead of harming them by letting them free range. You know? I took my son out of middle school. So the equivalent of 6th, 7th, 8th, and a second, eighth grade, if you will, 4 years. And so it went from like 10 to 14 because I saw that the school was killing his love of learning. Yeah. And I said, we can't do this. You know, I mean, kids inherently love to learn and you're just being sucked dry. And so at first I tried the programmed version, you know, and not totally, like I didn't buy a whole homeschool thing, but we set up protocol. So it would be like, okay, vocabulary, pick an article out of this National Geographic and read it and choose 5 words that you don't know and look them up and learn them. You know, like we would do things like that and or get on Khan Academy and watch some of the math videos on Khan Academy or pick a subject for the week that you're interested in and come up with 25 questions and I'll circle 5 that I think you should try to see if you can find the answers for. Cool. So we did it kind of like that.
Very cool.
Two things happened that were very interesting. At first it was a battle, right? Because it was still too programmed. And I was like, you know, after 2-3 months, I'm like, I'm not having this battle with you for the next 3 years. So I was like, you know what? You're on your own. Like, forget it. I'm not doing school with you anymore. You're just unschooling. And so at 10, I was like, enough of this school nonsense. Now, keep in mind, my husband and I both have PhDs. So it's not like we're anti-education, but we were anti the programmed education.
Yeah.
And so he freewheeled it for like 1 or 2 months. He was like, whoa, I don't know, all my friends are in school and I'm not. and then he came to me and said, well, you know, if I eventually want to go back to school, I don't want to be totally clueless. So what kinds of things should I be looking at? You know, so when it became self-directed, and then I would give him some direction and then off he went.
Wow.
And we did this for 4 years. So 4 years of unschooling, he was 100% in charge of his education. It was things like I had a business trip to Spain. So I brought him along. And I said, okay, well, we're going to have 3 days in Barcelona and 3 days in Granada. I'll take care of the hotel and pay for dinner. You figure out the rest. And so at 12, he was doing research into like, well, what do you do in Granada? And what do you do in Barcelona? And what's the exchange rate? And how do we get there? And like, I just had him figure out. And he was fine, you know? And yeah, some things didn't work, but so what? You know, that's how we learned and that's how we figured it out. So he did these four years. Two things, crazy. He decides that at 10th grade, he wants to go back to high school because he kind of wants somebody else to tell him what to do for a change. This is what he said. So he went back to high school. Didn't like it, of course, not surprising. But didn't miss a thing. Had not missed a single thing. Was on par with his peers, if not further ahead. Hadn't missed any content. 4 years of education. Shocking. And then he, you know, struggled, scrambled, made it through school. And he just started a month ago at an alternative college that doesn't have grades, lets you choose your own curricula. And they accepted him because he'd had this experience. Right? Because he didn't look like all of the other kids that had been farmed out programmatically. In fact, his college essay was, I am not your typical college applicant. I didn't, you know, have a tutor for my SATs and I didn't do all of this programming stuff of what you're supposed to do to get into college. Instead, I just, you know, left school for 4 years, you know, and, so anyhow, I'm not just speaking this in theory. This is the way that I have seen works. And you have to trust. You have to trust in your kids. You have to trust in nature's ability to help take care of them. And the world can be a different place. And we're going to go there. Like, we just swung way too far, right? Mm-hmm. On one side. And a lot of people, and thankfully your generation is going, what the hell were you guys thinking? And we have to do something differently. And starting to question that and change those parameters. So on behalf of my generation, I'm sorry. But we didn't know any better, right? Like, I mean, most people didn't know any better. We were told this was the way to be happy and healthy and safe. And so.
Yeah. And it's scary in a lot of ways, because we were raised with this idea that you have to, you know, go to school, get a job, and, you know, marry somebody by this age, and like have kids by this age, and then buy a house. And then it was all, you know, very simple and kind of programmed out. But then when we actually went through life, it wasn't like that at all. So we kind of had to just figure things out.
Yep. Yep. That's exactly true, which is great. Like, having to figure things out is what the world demands, you know, right now at this moment in time and the decades ahead, right? I mean, you know, for me personally, I'd like to believe that we're all going to be well and healthy and happy and, you know, but it's not looking very good. Right? I think it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better. And there's going to be a lot of tragedy ahead in the decades ahead. Humans are going to make it. We inherently are incredibly resilient. So as a species, we're not going to disappear. Although I'm sure there's a number of other species that would vote us off the planet if they had a vote. But we're going to need to develop the work that I do in the world is about trying to reduce the size of those catastrophes, right? Do everything we can, and to create as many healthy models for the other side. Right? Like, okay, we know that way didn't work. So it's, rather than say, what the hell do we do now? We will have things that we can draw upon, because while they may not be scaled fast enough, at least they're demonstrated as proof points of this is how it can be done better. And this is how the world could be. This is how we could make materials that aren't harmful and don't you know, require lots of energy. This is how we could do healthcare in a way that actually helps people heal. This is how we could build communities and cities in a way that actually gives back to the local ecosystem, as opposed to just drains the local ecosystem. And so each of our examples and the work that we do are those proof points to say, yes, this is possible. And it's not perfect by any means, but look at what can happen, especially if we start changing the whole system where we can support some more and more of these efforts.
I'd love to talk more about that. You know, what those possible future scenarios look like and what the growing pains on the way to get there look like. I think, you know, telling people what potential downsides included in those future versions would help them to kind of mentally prepare for that and know that there's a light at the end of the tunnel as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if you think about what humans have accomplished on some scale, right? We put our mind to it and look what we have created, say, in the last 250 years, because it's been bottom up, right? It's been an emergent phenomenon of all these people moving towards the similar vision. If we put our minds towards solving climate change collectively, we could solve it in 10 years, right? Like, so there's no question about what's possible. So it is a matter of choosing that, right? And it's choosing it at a holistic, comprehensive space. Right? So you can't be like, oh, I'm all for preventing climate change. Look, I recycle all my packaging, and then you're still driving an hour commute every day. Like, don't bother with the recycling. Like, I mean, the amount of carbon that's coming out of your tailpipe, far greater than the amount of packaging that you may or may not actually be recycled just because you put it in the recycling bin. And so, but part of that is demanding that we change the whole dynamic, right? You're probably driving that commute for an hour to have a job, which you believe is paying you plenty, You may not be very happy with the job, but you've been led to believe that you need the highest paying job. So you go for that. But why do you need that money in the first place other than to consume things that now you have to recycle? So like if you just rechanged your whole narrative, like my children and my family, we only buy used clothing. Like maybe in 20 years of raising them, have I bought them a new item of clothing maybe 5 times. And we're not wearing rags. Like there's so much good stuff at the Goodwill, right? It's like the most beautiful story ever. You know, it's stuff that would go in the landfill. So you give it a longer life, especially when they're growing up, right? You change clothes all the time. They grow so fast. And you wear it, and then it becomes a rag, you know? Or if it still has some life because they've outgrown it, then it goes back to the Goodwill. You donate it back. They provide employment for people that wouldn't otherwise be able to get jobs. And they, you know, the money goes to housing. It doesn't go to some corporate executive in Minneapolis, you know, or whatever. Like it's just a beautiful story, but it's not difficult. It's not a lot of these things, this sort of collective emergence of how we're going to do things differently are not difficult. It's just a choice. And it's a combination of embracing that what we do want, but you can't just do that in an additive form. You also have to create space to embrace what you want by eliminating that which you don't want. So if you eliminate your 2 hours of commute, 1 hour each way, suddenly you have 2 more hours in your day where you can really spend time exploring the woods with your kids. Right? Or whatever it might be, like there's opportunity, as opposed to feeling harried, like the parents you were talking about, like, oh, my time has been this and this and this and this. Like, to what end? And what can give so you have the space to do that on the other end? And then, you know, standing up for those ideals. And it's, you know, it's a shame that my generation looks at the, you know, the millennials, the 20-somethings, and they need to grow up and get a job, you know. And it's like they're just channeling whatever their parents told them, but it's secretly they're envious. They're like, oh, that's so cool that you're pursuing your passions, because that's how it's gonna change, right? Like, that's how it's gonna change, where people say, I don't want this story. I don't want this narrative that you, I want to live in a healthy planet. I want to live where I can take my kids out into nature. I want to live in a space where people are kind to each other. You know, like this is who I want to be, and then work towards that. The challenge, of course, is that we've invested so much in these other systems. Yeah. There's so much embodied energy and systems. You know, I'm trained as a Dana Meadows systems fellow, and Dana Meadows is a brilliant systems thinker. And she talks about, unfortunately, she's passed away, but she talks about how systems are inherently designed to maintain themselves, mm-hmm. whether they're healthy systems or unhealthy systems, right? So there's a lot of checks and balances that are keeping an outdated system around, right? And for example, take the banking system, right? We don't yet have an alternative. There's some really great models out there, but people are not yet ready to embrace them. So most people, no matter how liberal and alternative you are, you still put your money in a bank. Right? You still have your savings saved up in a bank. And that money feeds the system that we don't want anymore, right? It feeds the disconnect and the disproportion of wealth, you know, in because of where it stacks up. We all know it takes money to make money. And so as soon as we are like buying into the, I have my money, I have it in a credit union, so a little bit better than a bank. But yeah, I mean, that's where it is. Now, 5-10 years ago, my husband and I said, you know, we don't trust the stock market. That's all just false, funny money. We don't want to participate in that system. We pulled our savings, our retirement out, and we put it into buildings. We put it into real estate structures that were in our own community that we could see, right? That we knew this was something that was tangible. It provided housing. It wasn't like, you know, some crazy paper money somewhere else in some corporate thing in a mutual fund around the world. And you can imagine if everybody's even made an active decision, you know what, I'm just going to invest in my own community, right? Like, I'm not going to invest in some digital dots that represent somebody somewhere else, but I'm only going to, and that's one thing that credit unions are good for, right? So the money stays in the local community. And I don't know what the equivalent is in Bulgaria or elsewhere, but it's basically a locally nonprofit, local community bank that's nonprofit. And it provides loans for people in the community to develop what they want to do. And there's a couple of, like, Triodos Bank in the Netherlands, and there's some others that really have those kinds of goals and ethics and standards that are saying, you know, we need to change this. And so those are the kinds of things that will ultimately and slowly disrupt the systems that they need to retire. They need to go extinct. They need to transition.
We definitely feel that. We've been living on crypto for several years now, cryptocurrencies. Blockchain, Ethereum, Bitcoin.
Yeah. So there's a great example of a disruption and an alternative option. And, you know, it's interesting. So my son's very interested in that and he's following that. And when I, and there's the part of me, when I first heard about it, I was like, what? Like, I'm not buying that. Nah. You know? And so there is a comfort that comes from that which is familiar. Right. And that's, I want to speak to that for a minute, because it touches on what we talked about earlier. When we spend our evolutionary history through 290,000 years in nature, our brains require a lot of energy, a lot of metabolism, right? So a lot of the food we eat is fueling the brain. The brain is there to interpret the surroundings and make decisions and how to ensure your survival. We have something that's called cognitive bias. And cognitive bias is essentially from our hunter-gatherer days. It says, I have to at some point call a tree a tree, recognize it as a tree, and move on. Because if everything I'm looking at, I have to constantly process and make sense, and is it threat? Is it opportunity? Is it what, you know? I would be eating all the time just to fuel the brain to do that processing. So the brain goes, oh yeah, tree, safe. I know, never have I been hurt by a tree before, except, you know, Uncle Joe many, many years ago got hit by a branch, but whatever. Like, okay, I can move on. And we do that with so many things, and it carries through into our world today. And that's why there's racial profiling. There's all these things that are just our cognitive biases. It's our brain, if you will, being lazy, saying, I don't have enough energy to assess this afresh, to assess this anew and determine whether or not it really is dangerous or not. So when my son approaches me and says, you should check out this crypto thing, I'm like, I don't have the brain power for that. So I'm going to default to some skepticism because it's unknown, unfamiliar. And I'm going to stick with this thing called credit unions that I know about, right? That I can feel. And as long as we're aware that that's what our brain is doing, as opposed to using those biases to immediately classify other as dangerous, as threat, as it's simply like, I just don't have the bandwidth to assess, you know, and at least if we could just start at neutral, right? And that's where our society suffers from today.
Do you think your bandwidth for that? Afraid of others. Do you think that decreases with age, your bandwidth?
I don't know that the bandwidth decreases with age, but obviously the imprinting and the patterning, right? So neurons firing over and over and over and over and over again, it doesn't mean they can't learn and they can't be anew, but there's a lot more quote unquote experiential evidence. Like in the case of the credit union, I've not had a bad experience, and I've been with credit unions for 25 years. So that's so many years of good things happening that why would I need to disrupt that, right? Why would I need to change that necessarily? And most people haven't had a bad experience with a bank, you know, even though they didn't pay attention to where their money went or whatever it might be. But I think that looking And being open is available to anybody at any age. It just, it takes a little bit more effort because of, you know, these many years of experience in one way versus another.
The brand new Future Thinkers members portal is now live. Develop your sovereignty and self-knowledge with our in-depth courses. Get access to our weekly sense-making calls, join the Q&As with past podcast guests, and much more. Become a Future Thinkers member today at futurethinkers.org/members. To stay up to date with new episodes, subscribe to Future Thinkers on your favorite platform. And leave us a review or a like. It really helps out the show. And don't forget to share this episode on social media. You talked about kind of modeling new systems in different, all different areas of human activity. I'm interested if you have some ideas about how communities can be created in a way that is more in line with nature and with human nature as well, and more sustainable and healthy.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's interesting. We've had the opportunity to work on some varying different projects in different parts of the world, bringing biomimicry in. Some have been, like we worked on one in the early stages where India was anticipating 100 new cities of 1 million people or more in the next 25 years. Like, I mean, it's just mind-boggling, right? 100 of 1 million people or more. And so we worked on one of the city plans for that. And what we worked with HOK, which is a large architecture firm that was the planning group for the city. And it was outside of Pune in the Maharashtra district. So a couple hours away from Mumbai. And we asked a couple of questions. One was what we call genius of place. We said, well, what would nature do here? Like, what are the rules of this particular ecosystem? And we also did that in a development project called Lavasa, also nearby. In this particular ecosystem, they get many meters of rain, up to 11 meters of rain in a 3-month period, and then nothing the rest of the year. So what does it mean to learn from how the local species do that? So we do that genius of place work in different projects around the world. And one of the things that helps us see is what are the driving factors that are critical to life surviving here. And in that particular region, it was an abundance, an excess of rain in a short period of time and a lack of rain the rest of the year. And so if you keep that in mind, not in the classic, well, obviously then we just need to build dams and lakes so that we have the same amount of water available to us year round, but instead think about, well, how do we programmatically live in these 3 months? And how does that look different than the other 9 months? And having some of those conversations is critical. We did another project in Bandar Bari Sagawan in Borneo and the capital of Borneo, or Brunei on the island of Borneo. And there it became very clear that that ecosystem is driven by flooding. And again, rather than think about, well, how do we prevent flooding, like flooding is critical to that ecosystem thriving, it's how do we work with flooding? How do we work with the city in such a way? How do we design the waterway along the river so that we can embrace the floods and see them in the rejuvenating way that they offer as opposed to the threatening way, right? So a lot of it is a mindset kind of shift. And then the other thing that we worked on with that, and we haven't done as much with it recently, something we called FIT, which stands for fully integrated thinking. And every city has a set of parameters or needs and requirements. We have to store water. We have to clean water. We have to transport water. We have to provide education. We have to transport people. We have to provide energy. We have to deal with waste and so on. Right? So you have all of these functions that a city must have. And then we have a set of principles that we call life's principles. And there's 26 of them. They are, if you will, the golden rules, right? This is what all of life does, all 30 million species, like non-negotiable, follow this or go extinct. So it kind of behooves us to think about as a species, maybe we ought to follow those same rules. And so if you build a matrix of all those functions of the city with all of the life's principles across the top, And then you can start looking at the different ways. So the first city that I mentioned, for example, we did the analysis and they had done the city, and we get to wastewater management and we get to the resilience square, how nature does resilience. And they go, oh my God, we have a city of 1 million people and we've only put in one wastewater treatment. Like, bad idea. And so this gave them the opportunity. Not only did they then redesign it, so now they had three, they distributed those three in different parts of the city and they designed them to be three different kinds of treatments. And then they interconnected them so that they would have that sort of resilience. We looked at, you know, water, and then you asked the question around, say, water acquisition. You couple the life's principles with what does this ecosystem do? Well, it gets the bulk of its water from the sky. It doesn't actually get it from groundwater. So then you say, okay, well, how can you design your city so that you're planning on getting the bulk of the water from the sky? And what does that tell us about who lives here? What kind of things should happen here? You know, the proverbial, should we be growing rice in drought California? Like, you know, like what we have to be asking these questions and recognize that we're just so disconnected from the reality. So all of those pieces about how do we build community stem from place. Like they right. must come and be a byproduct of place. And it's only since the Industrial Revolution, I think, that we've really gone astray from that sense of place. Like, if you look at, of course, indigenous architecture, or even, you know, Europe, I think is far more, a much more beautiful example of this, because Europe developed before the car, right? So the story of each of these cities and communities is far more closely attuned to place. Whereas so much of America and Canada, it was like, well, the car, so you could, you know, you build this and this, or, you know, post-industrial revolution, we've got energy, we can build whatever we want. And you know, and so it's sort of like, it's so funny because most people today think it's so sophisticated, right? Look at what we could accomplish. And I look at it and I'm like, man, that is so crude. Like, it is so crude. It is not elegant at all. It's like a big block of something. If you want something that's sophisticated and elegant, make it work as well as that tree outside. Right? Like, that's what we should aspire to. And that's really where my story and connection with biomimicry started. Is I always loved nature. I was always a biologist. And even as a young kid, like if I look at my journals from when I was in high school and a teenager, I was asking questions like, how could people be so clueless? Like, how can they be designing in a way that is so different from the way nature designs? Like, nature's got us beat, hands down. I didn't get it from my parents. I just saw the world that way. And then, yeah, it's now I'm here where I am. It's what I do. I'm trying to get other people to see the world the same way.
I love this idea that we can learn from nature in each place, and that it's not a one-size-fits-all solution that we can just replicate endlessly and kind of force ourselves, force our boxy designs into every corner of the world.
That's right. That's exactly right. And in fact, you know, I think it's one of the mistakes that a lot of the, even the progressive sort of alternative solutions that are out there, they build it and then immediately ask the question, well, how do we scale this? Right? Yeah. Like, how do we make this available to everybody around the world? You don't, right? Like, you simply don't. You need to think about what is the local version of that look like. That's what you can scale. So for example, there's this German company called Zelfo. And what they designed is brilliant. It's basically like if you've ever worked in a clay studio and, you know, the slab rollers where it's like a big metal roller and you push the clay through and it rolls out this perfect, beautiful slab. And then you can build with the slab. And what theirs is a version of that. It's small, but it takes any cellulose waste product. Right. So corn husks or the bottom of broccoli stalks or whatever, it doesn't matter. Hay fields. and it runs it through a press, very low energy. And then because of the way they designed it, the cellulose essentially binds and bonds together. So what comes out the other end is sheet goods for building materials. Like you get like a piece of plywood, if you will, a plywood substitute. And so their technology is something that can be locally attuned, right? It's not like they designed it and they perfected it for hay only, and then you can only feed hay into it. But no, any community anywhere, like think about like post-hurricane, you could bring in one of these units, all of this dead biomass, which has fallen from the trees or whatever, and they're trying to figure out what to do. And, you know, most of the times they pile it up and burn it, right? It was awful. So at a minimum, it ought to be composted so that you have soil, or you run it and feed it through this machine. And now suddenly you have the building blocks to rebuild the community, right? To rebuild the city. So that's how we have to be thinking about, you know, all of these solutions that we need is the version of scaling must include a locally attuned component. Right? Like that's one of the life's principles. In fact, nature is locally attuned and responsive. And there's no pandemic species, you know, that is, except for humans, that lives on every planet or every continent and acts and behaves in exactly the same way. But yet we think we can take a McDonald's and yeah, they might serve mango juice in the Philippines instead of orange juice, but like, it's still the same cookie cutter thing.
You know, that was one of the bigger lessons I learned from a building workshop, natural building workshop we went to a few weeks ago. They were instructing us on how to test the materials because every site, even on the exact same site, every kind of difference of hill elevation and materials will completely change what you can do on that site, change all the materials, everything. And so we did this block test to test the strength of each of these natural building blocks we were making out of cob. And in order to figure out how much cement do we need to add to it in order to make it, you know, strong enough, load bearing, so that we can build several stories out of it. And that was quite surprising to me how, you know, my expectation just out of ignorance was that we could just ship in materials. Every place had the materials and we can just build that way. But yeah, I mean, he taught us that the structure and the design and everything changes depending on where you are.
That's exactly right. Well, and then the beauty of that is the elegance comes in the process, right? Mm-hmm. So that took time, but that time was really well spent, right? Like that's what made your solution elegant, because you became so intimately familiar with the materials. And if you were attuned to that local place, over time, you'd be like, you know what? The soil on the north slopes is just not going to cut it. Like every time, you know, I tested it a few times and it just was like, it failed. So let's not even bother with that one in the testing, right? And so you become more and more refined over time. And maybe this is where cognitive bias serves us well, right? So the elders of the community that have been doing cob forever can say, well, I can kind of tell, I can just feel it, I know. And that is elegance, right? Like that, and that's what I think most people, when we talk about the loss of, you know, indigenous knowledge and wisdom is what they're really lamenting, is that elegance of that intimate relationship with understanding. But now that took time. Like when I was probably your age, my 20s. And I was like, I'm going to live off the land. I'm going to do all of this myself. And, you know, and I had a wood stove. I lived in Montana. So I had to, I was like, I'm no chainsaw for me. I'm cutting all this wood by hand. I have a bow saw out. And, oh man, it was a lot of work. Eventually I was like, okay, I need a boyfriend that has a chainsaw, because this is really hard. But, and I wanted to, you know, but I found myself, and this is part of that systems challenge. I could make my own soap, right? But I need to spend a whole day in order to make my soap for the year. Or I could work for that day and buy my soap. Like you couldn't do both. Like you couldn't have a job and be completely independent. And it was really sort of, it was tormenting because I really wanted to live up to these ideals. And I was in graduate school and I was studying and I, it was very difficult to do these two things hand in hand. And so it's been working towards trying to find ways to do that. And that's where we've lost community, right? Mm-hmm. If you look at, and I would imagine it's true in Bulgaria, my husband's German, and so I speak German. And if you look at German names, like my last name is Baumeister, right? So Baumeister is, some people say it's the master farmer. Some people say it's the master builder, but that was their job in the community, right? So like the Baumeister was, well, you go talk to him because, or she, because they know carpentry, right? Like they're the ones that can help you with this. And if you look at all German names, you know, Schildwachter, you know, it was the one that polished and made the shields, you know, and then every name is a description of your role in the community. And we've lost that, right? Because that when we got money, you didn't need to barter and have community in the same way where we say, okay, I'll tell you what, I'll raise the pigs, you make the soap, right? And then we can figure it, we can figure this out. And again, that's another piece that's just disconnected us from place, because why make my own soap out of my local plants? Because I can buy soap from China, you know, whatever. And we have these crazy, and it's just compounding, right? It's just compounding. But what I love is what's happening now is people are like, okay, yeah, this is the world, but it just, something's not right. Like this just doesn't feel right. Like there is that underlying sense of discontentment. And that's where I think we get back to your question, where we can have, you know, hope again is people saying, no, I don't want to play this game anymore. You know, something different has to happen.
Another thing that I didn't realize until more experimentation is how much more abundant this type of living can be, like both taking into account community and the land and the materials on the land. Like that was one lesson from that building workshop I received, was that, you know, if we want to make an addition to our house, it's really easy. Go dig up that hill over there. You don't have to ship in wood and all kinds of stuff. It's going to be really, really, really cheap to do that. And on the same level, when I was living in big co-living situations when I lived back in Canada, you know, there'd be like 8 people in a house. We could afford things, you know, we could afford to buy a big TV when it would only be one tiny TV, or we'd be able to afford the kitchen appliances that wouldn't be available otherwise.
Yep. Yep. No, that's very, very true. But so my husband and I, and it's funny because, so we've built or remodeled a number of houses. And that's why we bought this one that we're working on. But one of the first joint purchase that we made when we got together 25 years ago was a sawmill, a portable sawmill. And, you know, it wasn't like, oh, we bought our first couch together. No, it was a sawmill. And then in living in Montana, then you went out with your trailer and you cut a log and then you brought it home and then you milled your own lumber. And now I'm here in Washington and the sawmill's in Montana and I need a piece of wood. And I'm like, I have to buy this? Like, this is traumatic. Like I want to go out in the backyard and mill that piece of wood, right? And so then I have this deep connection with that, right? Like I may actually remember the tree that we felled to get that. And then you cherish the wood so much more because you've seen it in its whole life. So part of our remodeling work here, we're using every piece of wood over again. Like, I mean, if it can be used, we'll pull the nails, we'll use it again, because I can see the tree that it was once part of. And I want to make sure it's fully embraced. My husband and I say, when we take a trailer load to the dump, that stuff is so done. There's no more useful life out of it whatsoever. I mean, because we had a wood stove in Montana, if it was a little piece of lefty you couldn't build with, then it was burned, right? Like then it was the warmth for the winter. So there's very, very little that we create, you know, waste. And then you go and you're like, when you see what other people throw away, it's heart-wrenching. But it's because we've been part of that system and part of that narrative. And then the opportunity that that provides, right? That opportunity, like I can build in new ways, or we've actually built quite a bit of wealth in, if you will, in many ways, because we learned how to do it. Like electricity is not that hard. You can figure out and learn how to do electricity, and you can learn how to do plumbing. And when you do that, you don't have to pay somebody $80 or $100 to put it in or fix something for you. And I learned in community. I learned in community with others who were trying to figure it out or were willing to help a young person like me who was eager to figure it out. And that has made us so much better off. In turn, has given us the freedom to choose the work that we most want to do in the world, even if it's not paying the bills, because, well, we don't have that many bills. Like that's the beauty of it.
Yeah. You know, the community aspect, I think, is so important, and it's been so lost, because now when everything is transactional and everything can be done with money, then that those relationships in the community have deteriorated because of that, because you don't really need to know your neighbors anymore. You don't really need to, you know, actually look at people. And I know I'm guilty of this too. Sometimes I just go on autopilot when I walk into a store and, you know, barely say hello to the store clerk. And then I'm like, oh, wow, that's really terrible.
And, you know, it's been funny, like I, having just moved to Bellingham here, which is delightfully full of really friendly, nice people. And, you know, where I lived in Montana, they were nice enough. Like I didn't know anybody, it seemed nice, right? But people go out of their way to be ultra friendly here. And I think it creates a reinforcing loop, right? So when you've had a really nice conversation with the store clerk, then the next person you see, you're more likely to engage in and have a conversation with. And so then it just becomes this, and it's beautiful. It's beautiful. Like the, you know, the sanitation guys that come with the recycling is asking me how our project's going, right? Like how's it? I'll keep an eye out for any, you know, lumber that I see that you might be able to use, you know, whatever. Like, I mean, that's what community can provide you when we have that conversation. But you're right. We have to get off of autopilot and be really mindful, and just start seeing people. And I think if people can feel seen, then we start seeing where we have far more in common than we believe.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. It was interesting at this building workshop. It was like so many little lessons, but actually really, really profound ones. It was all just a bunch of volunteers, and we were all working together towards this common goal of building this house that was going to be used for education workshops in the future. And like none of us are professional builders, just the facilitators have experience, and but we made it work and everybody contributed, and it was such an amazing bonding experience, even though a lot of us had very different views on the world. There's just something kind of
something about manual labor in groups like that. It just kind of brings you together.
Manual labor.
Sweating together and
Yeah. And eating together and like sitting by the fire together. It's a very, very bonding activity. And you just see the humanity in other people a lot more.
That's exactly right. And which has always been there, right? Like it's always been there, but we sort of sadly have forgotten it, right? Like the old barn raising days, right? You could never build a barn by yourself. It took the whole community, but the whole community was happy to help because they knew you were going to help when they needed their barn, you know, built. Yeah. And we will get back to that, and maybe not by choice, right? Yeah. When the larger systems start crumbling, which they will, they've grown so big, they can't maintain themselves anymore. When they start crumbling, then we will see that people suddenly have to start looking at their neighbors for help, you know, and having those conversations about, oh, okay, we've just been cut off from the rest of the world. How are we going to make it? Mm-hmm. We'll figure it out. I mean, it's, again, we've got, you know, 300,000 years of experience of working in communities, and it's just the last couple of centuries where we've started to see that erode, or even just decades in some places, you know, and so it won't be that hard to bring it back.
We really haven't been any happier during that time in this hyper-industrialized world. You know, I wouldn't say that happiness has been an abundant factor here. And yeah. Maybe going back might not be so painful if we realize that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it definitely, certainly if you look at the statistics, like depression, suicide, all those things are like not looking good for humanity. But I think one thing to be, I don't know that we're going back. We're creating a new version of it, right? Mm-hmm. We're creating a modern version of community. But it will require eliminating and stripping a lot of things that we've sort of taken for granted, that we're not seeing the full impacts of what they bring. And when we can replace those with an alternative that serves in not replica ways, but other fulfilling ways, then I think we'll figure out that path forward. And it is that many years ago I came across a master's thesis, and this individual had, and I can't find the reference anymore, it was too long ago, but they had interviewed a bunch of future thinkers and asked them what they thought the future would bring. And what this, I think it was a gentleman, thought came up with for his thesis is that when he took all these interviews together and put them on a matrix, that there was this deep pattern. And if you think about 2x2 matrix, and on one side was catastrophe, no catastrophe, and the other side was people change, people don't change. And he found that every single person he interviewed fit in one of those four quadrants. You know, so there were, say, the optimistic futurists that were like, oh, technology's great, and nobody has to change, and there's no catastrophe, and all will be beautiful, right? So he had those. He had ones that were like, people don't change, there's a catastrophe, you know, it's the end of humanity forever, right? The extinctionists, right, were in there. Then you had like the people will change and we will avoid catastrophe, right? That we'll figure it out, we'll start singing Kumbaya and all will be good and no catastrophe, right? Yeah. But they'll change, you know, people. And then you had the ones that were like, the catastrophe will actually bring about the change, right? That will call, and then we'll see something different on the other side, sort of the apocalypse and then coming out of it on the other side. And I thought that was really interesting because I bet everybody you interview and in your world would find themselves in one of those four categories. And then you behave accordingly. Right? You behave in how you act in the world and the questions you ask and how you see depending on those four. And I would imagine it would be awfully difficult to move somebody from one quadrant to another quadrant. Like if you're already convinced the world is doomed, then why try? Like just have fun and go down in flames. Who cares? Like, you know, I mean, you can, and there's plenty of people who think that way, yeah. Right? Really sadly. And the ones who are like, you know, that are always out there protesting and we got to do it differently. Like they really believe that we can get people to change and they keep fighting that hard fight. You're not going to tell them, and well, you should just go home. You're like, I'm not going home. This is how I define myself, right? Like this is how I make a difference in the world. And then the technologists who are, you know, constantly pursuing solutions and it's okay, people, you don't have to change. We got this. Like we'll save humanity, right? They're not going to stop that work. And then I've already told you that I'm in this category of, well, you know, if I can make the catastrophe a little smaller, and if I can create the models so that the change on the other side will be the kind of change we want. And that's, you know, the work that I do in the world. I can't imagine being in any of the other three quadrants and behaving accordingly.
That's the same for us too.
Yeah. I would place us in the same quadrant. Like, people have the capacity to change, but it's very difficult and cognitively costly for us. And a lot of the time we need just a big, you know, kick in the head in order to do it. And nature is happy to provide the kicks in the head.
And I agree with you there. I think people do need to change. It's very difficult to change. And on the other side, I've found myself in the technologist camp before where I've like, I just got this the other day. Raspberry Pi. And I'm like, I'm marveling at this thing because it's a computer now in the credit card sized box. And I'm thinking about how the cost of these materials and the waste of materials is going away. And I have this ability to execute all types of automation. It could be the foundation of our farming automation in the future when we start doing that. Just so many different things. So I see technology providing this opportunity, but I also see people not adapting in the way that is necessary. But I also see that those two coming together is going to produce a scenario where we have to adapt, and that's going to be too painful not to. So it's like everything seems to be going down a track of like, yeah, this is all about right.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we need all of it, right? Like, so just like we created this problem from the bottom up, we're going to have to fix it from the bottom up, right? So we need the Raspberry Pi in the world, and we need the activists out there, you know, shifting mm-hmm. and awakening people like Black Lives Matter or Me Too movement. I mean, those things created awareness, right? They created a new understanding, and they created dialogue, and they created conversation. So you need every one of these. You need the Gretas in the world saying, we are watching you, damn it, you know, and we're not impressed. So we need every one of these pieces in order to sort of cascade up. I was just at a technology conference of a company that makes the simulation software for engineers. So basically an engineer is called Altair is the name of the company. An engineer will make a part and then run it through this simulation software to say, does it handle the strains and the compression loads and so on. And then they made their place in the world by saying they have an optimization software that reduces the materials, lightweighting. And so they can remove 30 to 40% of the material of the part and still get the same functions because this software can test that. And if you imagine you using 30, 40% less material in the world, worldwide, like huge impacts for climate. And so I was asked to come in. I was the keynote speaker. And I just laid it on really thick with these engineers. I was like, hey, you are at the front end of these kinds of design decisions. And lightweighting is just one of them. There are so many things that you could add from learning from nature at this point that will be a heck of a lot of changing the way that we design things. And it was super impressive to see what this software was capable of. And I said, why is there not a little meter at the top that tells that engineer in real time how much carbon their design choice is making? You know, is emitting into the atmosphere or is not emitting because of a particular design choice. And it's not that far-fetched to imagine that being, it's totally possible now. Now, whether or not somebody wants to implement it is another thing, but it's totally possible to put that information right there at the front end. And now, yeah, technology could do things differently, right? That's part of that building in elegance into the space and giving us the opportunity to right correct this. And so I called upon the engineers in the room to find their inner superhero. And I was like, you need to go to work tomorrow and be super proud of the impact that you're having on the world, making the world a better place. And if you can reach people in that way, then we'll start seeing these kinds of shifts, you know, that we need to see.
You brought up at the beginning of the conversation this matrix that you would use to kind of, I suppose the way I understood it was kind of check off different areas that you could imitate nature. Is there kind of a system out there on the internet we can find that relates to this, that gives you different kind of lenses and lines to look at and compare your organization or technology to nature?
If you go to our website, biomimicry.net, and go to the design lens, find the design lens on the website, you'll find the life's principles and their definitions as a download. Lots of different people have created sort of templates of how to assess that. We've not yet made like a software tool or anything like that, but it wouldn't be difficult. Now, the challenge with some of these sort of checklists and assessments is we're very congratulatory, right? We like to pat ourselves on the back. And so we're like, you may have this design, like you could actually do an assessment of your podcast, for example, with this thing. And you could say one of the principles is locally attuned and responsive. And you can say, yeah, we always ask somebody where they're from. And so, and we've got that, you know, understanding about maybe how their local place led to their, so there, yeah, we're locally attuned and responsive. Check, move on, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so there's always a risk of that because we feel good that we've done that. But that's why the matrix of every, like you break down the podcast and you say, okay, the questions we ask, the room we use in, the people that we select, the way we share it on the, you know, the equipment, you know, you just break it down into all the parts and then you go across and you go, okay, is the questions we ask local? Yes. Check. Is the room that we're doing, is it all locally attuned and responsive? Oh no. You know, like, so then you go through each of those pieces and it's not meant to be, you know, this massive critique, but like, oh, look, here's the opportunity for us to bring this in that much more closer alignment. And so you could take any subset, any breakdown of whatever your world is about. You could take the natural building, right, and do that. And then, and what I have found, and so I teach a master's degree in biomimicry, and it's online. And we have people from all over the world that come and participate. They're usually working professionals and they say, yeah, something needs to be different. So they come back and study. They learn as much from each other as they do from the program. And one of the assignments is to go to, I have a, every year I find a different one, but some sort of award ceremony that's awarding all of these sustainability solutions and, you know, the best of class. And then they take life's principles and they do an assessment against that. Well, let's find out really how sustainable it is. And it isn't like, and in some cases, things are like, oh yeah, you line up, even though they didn't use the tool necessarily, but they're very well aligned. Others are like, wow, you totally nailed it on the material efficiency one and the benign chemistry, but you completely missed being resilient, adapting to changing conditions. And then they actually write letters to the inventors and say, hey, here's some ways to think about, you know, enhancing your solution and your design.
Very cool.
And so, yeah, the tool is really powerful. And the more I work with Life's Principles, I'm just blown away at, you know, what it could be. I am working on a book. We'll see if it ever actually gets out. But where I want to introduce the principles in a way that makes them accessible and ask some of those provocative questions of like, how can you bring your life into closer alignment with each of these principles?
I'm really curious how some of these principles apply to how we are socially with one another.
Yeah. So we teach a week-long workshop every year, Biomimicry for Social Innovation. And I teach with another woman who started a nonprofit called Biomimicry for Social Innovation. And she was one of my students and she came from like a sort of conflict resolution space and working with nonprofits. And we actually use the life's principles with the exception of the chemistry one, which is a hard fit to apply to social situations. It's always a little bit challenging and there's a lot of caveats in applying biomimicry to social innovation because, again, because of that cognitive bias, we have certain beliefs, how we think the world ought to operate. And so we can interpret the biology in a way that serves, you know, the message we want to get across.
Right.
I mean, Hitler interpreted survival of the fittest to serve his, you know, extermination activities or extradition. And so we have to be very, very careful around that. One of the things that we talk about is you can't use biomimicry to mandate or dictate human behaviors. But you can look at deep patterns to understand how we might shift or alter those behaviors. So for example, one of the things that we know is life cultivates cooperative relationships, right? And we presumably would like to have more of those in our world. And so we can, one thing we know in that realm is that when an organism has a high likelihood of encountering another organism again and again and again, then it's more likely to cooperate. Because if I cheat you this time and I see you again, there's a good chance you're going to cheat me, right? Like, not a good thing. So you can set up scenarios, say in your workplace, where you tell two people, you're going to be working together for the next year. Well, they're going to figure out how to work together because they don't have the option to go somewhere else. You mentioned that earlier, that you've got to figure it out. In fact, one of the best ways to deal with siblings fighting is not give them the choice to just, you know, argue and then go play with their friends. But no, you guys are your friends for today. Like, you figure it out. And they will. They will always work it through because they'd rather be in that space. And so those are the kinds of what we call habitat conditions that you can create in order to promote certain behaviors to arise. We already talked about, you know, getting on autopilot. And if you have this expectation, you have to deliver your kids to all these different places, then you don't have time to slow down and talk to the shop clerk. And so we've created a habitat condition so that the behavior of civility is in question. Right? So if we change the habitat condition, then we can actually create the space for those other behaviors to emerge. So in social innovation, and of course, I'm speaking very generally, but we have tools and processes and methods where you can say, for example, look at the process of succession in a forest and what makes succession work and build those kinds of phenomena into your organization so your organization can go through successional processes in a similar way. And so, yeah, it's a deep dive. We actually taught it this last summer in Slovenia, so not too far away from you guys. And it was beautiful. Slovenia was beautiful. And we're thinking about next summer in Iceland, which, you know, it's really just an excuse for us to go to beautiful places in the world.
Yeah. Cool.
It's very cool, the principles of life, because that would apply fractally in all size, in all sizes of systems and on all different levels of systems. Like, you could apply it in your individual life, you could apply it in your family, in your community, in your business organization, you know, at a country level, because those life principles, they are fractal.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And that they apply to every organism, right? And then what happens is an ecosystem follows life's principles, not because there's some sort of top-down directive, but every member of the ecosystem is following the life's principles. So the emergent property. Yeah. So you could say, if all of the system subsystems within our city were in alignment with life's principles, then the city would be in alignment with life's principles, because that would be the emergent phenomenon. So that's that working from the bottom up piece that we had talked about earlier.
Yeah, it's amazing how much systems design and habitat design can direct human behavior. And there's one good example. I think I might have told the story already, but I'll just tell it in brief just in case. I went to a conference a few weeks ago and met up with a whole bunch of people. It seemed like about half the people at this conference were from Sweden, from Stockholm. And I recognized that they all kind of knew each other and seemed to be close friends. And I asked them how they all know each other. And they said they lived in one co-housing flat in the middle of Stockholm. More than 50 people in one building. And you could tell and they talked about the arrangement of the building and how they had so carefully designed the habitat to provide for the best types of social interactions. And you could really tell that it was working because everyone seemed to be just at this excellent level of social awareness with each other and really close, even across, you know, maybe some groups of people within that community didn't quite pay enough attention to or pay that much attention to each other and didn't really know each other that well. But there was still this heightened level of social awareness of each other that was very obvious to an outsider.
Yeah. There you go. So it's possible, right? Like, it is possible with some mindfulness and intent. And it's not social engineering as much as it's habitat engineering. Right? Yeah. Like, and then people can still be whoever they are, but it creates that space. Like, I don't know if they have this in Bulgaria, but in Germany, most restaurants are big, huge tables. Right? And you don't have your own little isolated table with your 1 foot between you and your neighbor, like in the US. And so you naturally, because you're sitting on the same bench with whoever else has shown up, you start having a conversation, right? It's, you don't have to, but you've created a habitat condition that promotes that community connection.
Yeah.
Something super simple, but it can have a huge ripple effect. Huge ripple.
I love that stuff. I really love that stuff.
One thing that they have in Europe that I really love is that they have these little city squares everywhere. which promotes social interaction. It's not just going in your car from A to B. You walk through the square and you see somebody you know, and they're maybe talking to somebody else. And it's like there's always these little social interactions that are happening if you're just walking down the street.
Yep. And it, at the time, before cars, you know, people valued their community. This is the way we want to do this, right? So it's, I mean, it comes from the nomadic campfire, right? Like there was a spot where everybody knew you could always find somebody else. Like it's deep, deep within us. And the loss of that in bigger communities is huge, right? Like it's a huge loss. And that's what's neat in the urban revitalization projects where they're saying, let's recreate these community spaces, gardens, whatnot, where people can feel like they can find each other.
Cool. Thanks for joining us. This has been fun.
All right. This was Dr. Dana Baumeister from Biomimicry 3.8. To get all the links and show notes from this episode, go to futurethinkers.org/109. See you next time.
Enter the Future Thinkers giveaway and win our brand new community membership, including in-depth courses, private calls, and more, as well as a supply of Qualia, a complete cognitive upgrade for your brain. To enter the contest, simply go to futurethinkers.org/giveaway and sign up for our mailing list to instantly get our 50-page guide on how to adapt to the future. There are many ways to increase your chances of winning. Enter the competition today. The brand new Future Thinkers members portal is now live. Develop your sovereignty and self-knowledge with our in-depth courses, get access to our weekly sense-making calls, join the Q&As with past podcast guests, and much more. Become a Future Thinkers member today at futurethinkers.org/members. To stay up to date with new episodes, subscribe to Future Thinkers on your favorite platform. And leave us a review or a like. It really helps out the show. And don't forget to share this episode on social media.